From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and on Labor Day, this is Maryland Morning. Analysts last spring found that more people from the Sandtown-Winchester neighborhood in West Baltimore are incarcerated in Maryland state prisons than from any other census tract. We went to see two ex-offenders working to change that. Then former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank is known for his progressive politics and his wit, both evident in his memoir. We revisit his conversation with Tom Hall. Plus, Republicans have lost five of the last six popular elections for president, but the GOP is in charge of both houses of Congress. Why the difference? UMBC political science professor Thomas Schaller says he's got the answer in his book, The Stronghold. And critic Jaywin Russick reviews Fells Point Corner Theater's season opener, Detroit, about desperation in the suburbs. Now news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Where is home for an inmate? Until 2010, for census purposes, inmates in Maryland state prisons were considered residents of where they were incarcerated, places like Hagerstown, Jessup, and Cumberland. Of course, they aren't from those places, so that skewed the census data, giving rural areas a bump in population. But a 2010 state law said they must now be counted as residents of their last home address. That means that we now know exactly where Maryland inmates are coming from in the state.
Right here, to the left, this little thing here, this little hut.
Yeah.
This man adopted that lot right there. He sold candy and snowballs and things of that nature.
That's Anthony Warren. He's from West Baltimore's Sandtown-Winchester neighborhood.
I grew up in this house right here on the corner. For years. Actually, my mother lives over across the street over there.
A report in February from the Justice Policy Institute and the Prison Policy Initiative says that, as of 2010, 458 people from Sandtown-Winchester or neighboring Harlem Park were in a Maryland prison. At one point, so was Anthony Warren.
I had a homicide. I was out there living in that type of world, the fast life, the fast money and all of that. A guy that was known for hurting people and all of that or whatever, approached me with some negativity, saying what he was going to do, and he was known for doing what he said he was going to do. So it was either him or me at the particular time. So it turned out to be him. I did that. I served my time for that.
Warren is out of prison now and works with youth and ex-offenders. He guided producer Matt Purdy and me around Sandtown-Winchester earlier this year, before the notoriety that focused on the neighborhood after Freddie Gray's death in April.
Things have changed here, but it has been a lot of crime here. You know, if you ride around a lot of the corners, you'll see the police lights, the cameras and all of those things. You'll see that. But at one time, it didn't used to be like this. I mean, us as children, we grew up, you could go freely in this community, didn't worry about getting hit by any stray bullets or anything like that or what have you.
But Warren also showed us efforts, both from within the community and outside of it, to turn things around. A farm graces land where vacant homes once sat empty. A neighborhood park hosts community events in the summer. Tidy rehabbed homes line certain blocks. But there remain the harrowing statistics. In Sandtown, more than half the community of working age is unemployed. About a quarter are on temporary assistance for needy families. A third of homes are vacant.
There are a number of communities in Baltimore that are driving the incarceration challenge within the state.
That's Mark Schindler, executive director of the Justice Policy Institute, which put together the report. We spoke with him earlier this year.
We also know, in looking at both the incarceration research and the data on how these communities are doing on some key indicators, is that, not surprisingly, these are very distressed communities and are facing many challenges. And so it shouldn't surprise us that, unfortunately, there's a higher number of people in these communities who end up involved with the justice system.
And Schindler says that costs a lot of money, about $37,000 per year for one inmate. He argues that money could be better spent.
we know that for $37,000, we could pay for employment training for 7 people. We could pay for a 2-bedroom apartment for 30 families for a month, and we could provide GED courses for 37 people. And so it really is policy choices and budget choices that are implicated here. And so our belief is that when we have data like what was presented in this report, it's really an opportunity for policymakers, elected officials, and others to really make better informed decisions on how we allocate our precious public resources.
In Sandtown in February, we sat down with Anthony Warren as well as Antoine Bennett at New Song Community Church. Bennett is the director of Men of Valuable Action, or MOVA, which works with ex-offenders, helps them find jobs, provides mentoring. Anthony Warren is MOVA's Community Service Project Coordinator. The two men have a lot in common, both in their mid-40s now, both grew up in Sandtown, have family there, and both spent time in prison. Anthony Warren, as we heard, for homicide, Antoine Bennett for a shooting. Bennett said that what led him to prison is essentially the same drive that now leads him to help young men in Sandtown, the urge to be part of something bigger than himself.
I went to prison because I thought the guy that I idolized, he went to prison, he came out a man. And so I thought this, literally for me in my thinking, was a rite of passage. But certainly, looking back on the hindsight, these young men don't have to go to prison. They don't have to join gangs to one. And I really, when I look at the core of this thing, it was really about belonging to something. And that's why it was easy for me to connect with the guys in my neighborhood, in our neighborhood, and create, you know, this gang type lifestyle, and embrace it fully to the point where it resulted in me being incarcerated. We have to create avenues that are going to lead to positive outcomes. Prison is not the only trajectory for these young men.
The two have felt pain in the neighborhood as well as observing it. In 2005, Warren and his niece were caught in the crossfire of a robbery gone awry. He was shot. His niece, the mother of 5, was killed. That was 3 years after Warren's daughter was shot.
She was 8 years old, got shot in the chest in 2002. Where I saw this shoulder snowballs that around there, She was going around there to get a snowball right across the street. The little girls out there playing with the dolls or whatever. She stopped for a minute and started playing with them. Two guys got to arguing. Both of them pulled guns and started shooting on both ends at each other. They not even this close to try to shoot. They shooting from a distance. My daughter got hit in the chest. One little girl got hit in the stomach and in the foot. One little girl got hit in the back. One little girl, father tried to shield her, got his ear shot off. You know, had she been sitting facing either one of them, it would have hit her directly in the chest, pointing. But what it did, it went this way. And it didn't really penetrate her. It just like burnt her, which I was very thankful for that, You know. But that right there alone, it upset me and it really hurt me to see that happen. But for the most part, had I not been trying to change, that would have set me off, you know, because I'm like, this is my baby, you know. But by me trying, being in transformation, trying to do better, I held on, I prayed about it, and I say, well, you know what? I want to try to make sure things like this aren't happening at a larger scale, if any.
They don't argue violent offenders like they were should not go to prison. The argument is over sentences for nonviolent offenders.
If you statistically look at those who have been incarcerated, many of them are for nonviolent drug offenses, be it as drug sellers and or drug users. And we feel that, as Anthony stated, it should be other alternatives to that.
You both have poured so much love into Sandtown and seen some successes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the big headline right now is Sandtown leads the state in the number of young people it sends to prison. Mm-hmm. So I guess that raises in my mind the question, do those numbers reflect the reality of Sandtown?
I would say certainly. It's It's a hard reality that we have to deal with. Anthony and I could sit here and probably rattle off about 20 names, probably even more, of people we know personally who are incarcerated or who have repeatedly offended and out of prison all the time. And so we know a great deal of individuals in the community. We're talking close to 16,000 folks, so we don't know everyone, but by virtue of being lifelong residents here. And so we know that those numbers were reality over the last decade or so of people returning. And most of those folks, I would say 90% of those folks returning back to our community from these institutions are men. As I said before, that's why our intentional effort has been to address the needs of the men, because they are leading the way. And young men are leading the way in terms of being incarcerated and returning back to a single community. But I must admit that I was blown away and pushed back at the number being raised to 458 returning to our little community of Sandtown. And, you know, it's disheartening. I certainly think that that motivates us to work harder to really, really make the impact that we would like to see and that this community deserves as it relates to changing the mindset, helping to change the mindset of these young men and women, but certainly the men who are returning back to Sandtown with the label of offender, ex-offender.
That was Antoine Bennett, Director of Men of Valuable Action, or MOVA, which works with ex-offenders and at-risk youth. Anthony Warren is MOVA's Community Service Project Coordinator. Eric Colbert is the group's board chair. We spoke with them in February. At our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, we have a link to the Justice Policy Institute report. It's titled, The Right Investment? Correction Spending in Baltimore City. I'm Sheila Cast. More ahead. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us on this Labor Day Monday. We're going to revisit a conversation this morning that I had with a former congressman who has been considered a champion of the labor movement for more than three decades. Barney Frank represented the 4th Congressional District in Massachusetts for 31 years until his retirement in 2012, and he was in the middle of the mix during battles over some of the most historic pieces of legislation in recent American history. Issues like Wall Street reform and Don't Ask, Don't Tell bear his unique and unquestionable imprint. And in an autobiography that he published last spring, we get a glimpse behind the scenes in the Capitol during his influential tenure. I caught up with him last March, the day before he spoke about his new book at the Enoch Pratt Free Library. The book is called Frank, A Life in Politics, From the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. I found one of the most poignant dimensions of the book is Mr. Frank's chronicle of his long personal struggle as a closeted gay man. He entered politics in 1972, and he came out 15 years later, in 1987. In the book, he describes many occasions in which he planned to come out prior to that, and the various reasons he decided not to. I asked him if, looking back at those decisions now, he thought he could have come out earlier.
Only a few years earlier. It is clear to me that in 1980, I would not have been elected to Congress if I were out. I mean, it was a narrow win in any case. I did think by the mid-'80s, look, nothing important, I believe, in this area of basic social attitude, has moved as quickly in what I consider to be the right direction as the question of how those of us who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender should be treated. And we were making very quick progress. I probably could have come out, and I began to think about that a few years earlier. There was a complication. One of my close friends, since tragically died early, Gary Studs, we represented adjoining districts. We were both gay. We were closeted. We knew that of each other. And he got involved in a difficult situation. He had been emotionally, physically engaged with one of the House pages. He was censured. He had to fight hard to keep his seat. I couldn't come out while that was in the midst of things. That would have just complicated it. If that hadn't happened, I probably would have come out 2 years earlier, but not any much more earlier than that. I mean, it is true that things have gotten better, but by 1980, well, let me put it this way. In 1981, a Democratic House majority, a lot of conservative Southerners, but still a Democratic House majority, voted 3-1 to cancel, as it could then do, the vote of the District of Columbia City Council repealing the law against two men having sex with each other. So in a climate in which the U.S. House votes 300 plus to 100 plus to keep consenting sex a criminal act, that was unfortunately reflective of a considerable amount of prejudice still existent.
Sure. Of course, as you mentioned, the shift towards acceptance of gay people and gay, lesbian, transgendered, bisexual has been enormous and quick. And as that's happened, the LGBT community has gained considerable political influence that it didn't have 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and you've been a leader of that movement. What do you see the role of the LGBT community and its political influence moving forward?
Well, it's twofold, and of course, you know, it's relevant to talk about that because Maryland has been one of the areas where we have made the most progress in terms of elected officials. What was a big breakthrough for us, frankly, was when we had the referenda in 2012. And look, to be honest, there was a question about the African-American community and its attitude. And in 2008, when the referendum lost in California, 2010, the African-American community was somewhat against it. There's a very powerful church influence. And of all the states that have voted on this, the first one where there was a very large African-American population is Maryland, of course. And the fact that we were able to win in Maryland with the support of the leaders in the community politically, the members of Congress, that was a big breakthrough.
Yeah, of course, but it failed the first time. Failed the first time, and then
yes,
we won the second time, sure.
And what we the agenda is very simple. First of all, it is still legal in most of the states to refuse to hire someone or to fire someone because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. People are sometimes surprised to find that. But there is no legal right to a job, no matter how qualified you are, in many states based on your sexual orientation. Now, we have federal laws that protect people against that kind of unfair discrimination in every other category. The most important item is to pass a law that protects gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people against job discrimination. Next is important to make sure that people, where we do have legal rights, cannot simply say, oh, my religion says no, I'm not going to allow that. Yes, you respect religion, you respect the institutions, but you do not give individuals a license to mistreat people because they say their religion allows you. Beyond that, I would hope that the LGBT community would, on the whole, be a participant in efforts for social fairness. That is, I hope that we are not a movement that says, you know what, we're okay now, and that's it. We don't have any more political concern. We have fought very hard to get fair treatment for ourselves. We've been aided. I mentioned African Americans. The Congressional Black Caucus has been an outstanding ally consistently for LGBT people. It has collectively a very good record. I would hope that people like us who have known discrimination and to some extent have succeeded in the fight against it would be there to help other people who continue to face these problems.
Barney Frank's new book is called Frank, A Life in Politics, From the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. You served 20 terms in Congress. You arrived the same year as President Reagan. This book is in many ways a kind of treatise on the necessity of government and its potential for good. You are in so many ways the anti-Reagan. You know, his message was one of, you know, government being too much an interference in people's lives, and that argument still holds sway today with many people on the right. How do you reconcile the need for, you know, individual liberties and free markets and the need to be fair to everybody? I mean, what should the metrics be for progressives in terms of regulation and government presence?
That's obviously the central question. First of all, you begin with a recognition that we need two vigorous elements in this society. We need a free market. We need a private enterprise collection of entities, because that's where wealth is created, by people's activities. And you have to, I think it's clearly best you do that through the free market with all the incentives. You give people incentives to work. You have incentives so that people who produce something that the public wants are going to make more money than the people who produce things that we don't want. We get more of what we want. At the same time, sensible people have always recognized, until we get the Tea Party, this is the first time a political party has essentially rejected that, that the public sector has its role, but so does the private. The private sector has its role, but so does the public sector in several areas. First of all, as we just learned from the financial crisis, the public sector has to set rules for the private sector. You know, one of the things that we were told during the financial crisis, some of the bankers, we asked them, well, why were you doing this? That was kind of irresponsible. And the answer was, well, we had to do it because everybody else was doing it. We were under these pressures. So the federal government sets the rules. Secondly, there are very important things for the quality of life that the private sector won't do. I believe that public transportation, trains, buses, subways, those are very helpful. You know why we have those largely public? Because the private sector walked away. There used to be private street railways, private public railroads, private inner-city railroads, and the private sector said, we can't make money out of this, so we're walking away. Another example, in many parts of this country, private sector entities made things, they were very prosperous, and then the economy changed, there was no longer need for the product, they went out of business. They left behind them environmental damage. The public sector has to come in and pick it up. And then there was also the question that there are going to be people who will not prosper in the private sector, and the question is, do you leave them behind? Social Security and Medicare, people should remember, are major, massive government programs that were bitterly opposed by conservatives when they began. And they are the two most effective things we've had in reducing poverty among the elderly. Now, you need to have the proper balance. And in a healthy political system, there's a pushback, well, too much private or too much public. For the first time, we have a group of people who totally reject that. As far as Reagan is concerned, I give an example early in the book, because I understand what people say about this. In 1965, a large number of children had brain damage because of lead, particularly poor children in urban areas, but children in general in the country. And then the government stepped in. Congress passed two laws, one that banned lead from paint and one that banned lead from automobiles, under the Nixon presidency, by the way. And as a result of Congress banning lead by statute from those two private sector products, the incidence of brain damage caused by lead in children is down well over 90%. So as I said in that chapter, there are a lot of children today whose brains aren't damaged, and they can thank the fact that the government was there to help them, contrary to Reagan.
In addition to the central argument about whether government's a force for good or not, is a pervasive cynicism about government and about the people who are in the business of politics. At one point, you write here, I think it's both legitimate and politically helpful to make my ideological opponents look not just wrong, but also foolish, especially if I can use humor to do it. And you, sir, have a reputation for being absolutely one of the funniest politicians ever to hold the title politician. But I wonder, some folks might think that that's kind of part of the problem. What about the tone of the discourse in Washington?
Well, that's a fair point. I think I make this distinction. I ridicule their arguments. I ridicule their what I think of their inconsistencies and hypocrisies. I don't go after them personally. I don't impugn their motives. I don't think that the one necessarily leads to the other. What I object to is this notion that politicians are all evil and conniving. Look, one of the things that troubles me, I'm a great believer in free speech, so I let people say anything. I mean, I agree with those who say that those jerks in Oklahoma, those bigots who were doing what they did, should not have been expelled, because you have a First Amendment right to be a totally offensive bigot as long as you don't do anything physical to people. But if I had the power to say, okay, I'm suspending the First Amendment, I would take House of Cards off the air. That is an example of a distorted, bizarre misrepresentation of the motives and of how things work. So that's what I object to. Arguing that people are wrong about policy and are making arguments that don't make sense, that's important for debate. But impugning people's motives, suggesting that members of Congress are not trying. Look, even the Tea Party, I've defended Tea Party people. I vigorously disagree with many of them on most issues, but almost the ones that I've met, they're all sincere. They're not in there to make money. They're not in there to further some kind of conspiracy. They are people with grievously mistaken policy views, and I will do everything I can to ridicule those policy views, but I have to refuse to join in this personal denigration.
Former Congressman Barney Frank. His new book is called Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. We spoke here on Maryland Morning last March. More information about the book on our website. Come on over to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. Thanks so much for spending part of your Labor Day with us. There's more coming up. Stick around.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. On Mondays, even a holiday, we hear from our theater critic, J. Wynne Russick. She's seen the Baltimore premiere of Lisa D'Amour's Obie Award-winning comedy, Detroit, at the Fells Point Corner Theater in Baltimore. The play follows two couples dealing with suburban life and economic anxiety.
Lisa D'Amour calls her 2010 play, Detroit. But she herself has acknowledged that the play is set, quote, in a suburb of what could be any middle American city. That is, any middle American city beset with severe financial woes, unemployment, abandoned housing, and increasingly desperate members of what was once middle America's middle class. That's the backdrop for this Pulitzer Prize finalist, a play that's been staged from Chicago to New York to London. Now, Fells Point Corner Theater has produced the play's well-acted, well-directed Baltimore premiere. The action focuses on two couples. Ben is a recently laid-off banker, and his wife Mary is a paralegal. Their new next-door neighbors are Kenny, who works in a warehouse, and Sharon, who works at a call center. When the play begins, Ben and Mary have invited these new neighbors over for a cookout, a gesture of such warmth it moves Sharon to tears.
This is awesome. It is so awesome. I mean, who invites their neighbors over for dinner anymore? We've lived in a bunch of neighborhoods now, apartments, houses, condos, and never, never did our neighbors give us the time of day. Neighbors. I mean, why is that word in the dictionary still? It's archaic.
With her midriff bare and dressed in short shorts and boots, Rachel Roth plays Sharon as a motor mouth. Her words are as effusive as her clothing is skimpy. Roth delivers these words with a slight southern twang, and the raw immediacy of a young woman who lives entirely in the moment. Under the direction of Michael Byrne-Zemerl, Roth's performance is a standout in a lineup of carefully observed performances. We learn in the opening scene that Sharon and Kenny are fresh out of rehab, and as Kenny, David Shoemaker speaks with the slow drawl of someone who hasn't yet gotten the pharmaceuticals out of his system. The couple claims to have met in rehab, but that's the first of several things about Kenny and Sharon that don't quite ring true.
They have lived here 5 weeks, and there is no furniture in there, nothing except the coffee table and this one armchair with the stuffing hanging out of it. It looks like a dog ate it. And the tiny TV sitting on a cardboard box.
Well, they said they had no furniture.
And even in the bedroom.
You went in the bedroom?
I mean, there is not even a bed. There is this mattress-looking thing.
I don't know, Ben. It just makes me feel weird. I mean, who are we talking to?
Beth Weber plays Mary as initially the most reasonable of the foursome. But as her suspicions build, she becomes more and more hysterical, at times to excess, even in this context. In comparison, Gregory Jericho, as her husband Ben, comes across detached, a milquetoast. The two couples, one seemingly conventional and the other way out on the edge, wouldn't appear to have much in common. But a strange symbiotic friendship develops between them, a friendship that accelerates as their circumstances deteriorate. Much of Lisa D'Amour's career has been in experimental theater, but Detroit also owes a debt to such established playwrights as Harold Pinter and Edward Albee. Structurally, however, Detroit relies a little too heavily on monologues, and the sudden appearance of a new character in the final scene is more expository than organic. The shifting line between dreams and reality is a recurring theme in Detroit. But at Fells Point Corner Theater, the suburban houses where the play takes place are impressively solid structures, designed and built by Bush Greenbeck on a revolving set. Fells Point Corner Theater is housed in a former fire station, and it's calling its new season Fire in the House. That phrase has added meaning in Detroit, a play that sheds heat and light on the fears underlying the safety and security of suburban life.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Detroit runs until October 4th at the Fells Point Corner Theater on South Ann Street in Baltimore. I'm Sheila Cast.
Yeah, I just close my eyes this world. Let me crash it in a blazing fire. All you ever did was wreck me. Yeah, you wreck me. Yeah, you wreck me.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The Republican Party has lost 5 of the last 6 popular votes in presidential elections, but the GOP has found much more success in Congress. In January, already in charge of the U.S. House, they took control of the Senate. Republicans have been well represented in Congress for the past 2 decades. Why the discrepancy? Thomas Schaller answers that question in his latest book, The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress but Surrendered the White House. Schaller is professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC. We spoke about his book in January. In it, he asserts that it was because of Republican dominance on Capitol Hill that the party surrendered the White House. I asked him to explain.
Well, the numbers are there, at least historically, right? The Republicans won 7 of 10 presidential elections between Eisenhower and Bush 41's initial election. But then, as you point out, they've lost 5 of the 6 most previous presidential elections in the popular vote, 4 of the 6 in the Electoral College. Of course, Bush won in 2000 despite losing the popular vote. So they weren't used to be a strong presidential party and a weak congressional party. And then after the Reagan-Bush era, they became just the opposite. And how did that happen? So the book is a little bit about that chronology. But also, as you ask, how is one related to the other?
Can't you walk and chew gum? I mean, can't you both be strong congressionally and White House contender?
There are, of course, moments, and the Republicans did have unified government under George W. Bush, really, for the first time since the pre-New Deal era, other than the 2 years at the start of the Eisenhower administration. So why is that? Well, some of it's the voters. I mean, at the end of the Obama administration, 2 years from now, in January 2017, we will have finished a 64-year period in which we've had divided government. For 44 of those 64 years, 70% of the time, in almost every one of the 6 possible variations of control, because a party can control the White House and neither chamber, the party can control the White House and one chamber or so forth. And so the Republicans won the presidency first. If you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is that the Republicans were the minority party for so long, controlling nothing, and then they won the White House through Eisenhower, Nixon, Reagan. Then with Reagan, they won the White House and the Senate. Then finally with Gingrich, they won it all, but not the White House with Clinton. And they've lost them back in the same order. They lost the presidency back, then the Senate, and for the last 4 years, they had just the House. They were a House-only party, very similar to the way that Tip O'Neill and the Democrats had only the House in the first 6 years of the Reagan administration, and they were a very weak party. And you remember, this was the rise of Clinton Democratic Leadership Council centrism. It was Democrats who came in and said, we are a party controlled by our House wing. We're identified by our constituency groups, feminists, minorities, unions, the gays, right? This sort of notion that they were captured, right, by their horrible constituency groups. I'm using the sort of language that was used about the Democratic Party at that time, right? Well, now the Republicans, though they're a largely white-only party, they are actually captured more by their constituency groups and were dominated by their House wing. And their House wing can win elections in their very highly gerrymandered House districts, but can't necessarily win statewide, which is why they struggled with the Senate until recently. And then their message doesn't really play on the national level. So what the argument is in the book is that they became a strong congressional party. They became more conservative. As they became more conservative, they became more entrenched in the Congress at the expense of their ability to deliver an agenda and a message that can pass on a presidential level to a national audience.
So is the root cause of the trend you're writing about all about gerrymandered districts? Is it all about the members picking their constituents as opposed to the constituents picking them?
Well, that only applies, of course, on the House, right? You can't gerrymander a Senate district because the district is the state. So some of it has to do with that. And as I point out in the book, and many people observed after the 2012 elections, that Republicans got fewer votes nationwide in the House races, but they had more seats because they have gerrymandered the districts in a
very— And you say in the book, that's how gerrymandering works.
And that's how it works. And you can't really blame them for doing that. And you can't certainly blame Republicans for the fact that Democrats tend to be geographically concentrated in urban and inner suburbs. That's not their fault either. Capitalizing on it, that could be on them. And of course, they can't gerrymander the states, but as I show in the book in Chapter 6, the Republicans are overrepresented even in the Senate because they have a lot of small state senators, two from Idaho, two from Alaska historically, and so forth. So they've been overrepresented for 30 or 40 years going back to the 80s. In other words, having more seats in the Senate than the share of the population they represent from their respective states. And that wasn't always the case. Back in the 30s and 40s, the Republicans were underrepresented in the Senate when they used to have Republican senators from crazy places like California and New York where they don't have it now. So the Democrats are underrepresented in the Senate and the Democrats are underrepresented in the House. And this has created sort of a false canary in the coal mine phenomena. Republicans say, hey, we're doing pretty well here. We're controlling Congress. Our message must be working. But it's working despite the fact that a majority of Republicans in Congress represent a minority of the country. And so you get to the presidential elections and they're scratching their heads. Why do we keep losing these presidential elections? And it's because the messages that work for your states and your constituencies in the House districts sell pretty well. Think of Todd Akin in 2012 talking about forcible rape, and suddenly that becomes a national controversy. Why? Because in his home district, he probably talked about forcible rape in town meetings with conservative constituents, and they didn't blink an eye. They're like, oh, yeah, forcible rape. This seems like a perfectly legitimate reason to vote against abortion in the Congress. And Paul Ryan voted for forcible rape provisions in Congress, and same exact vote as Todd Akin, but because he wasn't talking about it, that's when it became a national issue, and suddenly you realize what works at home in your little congressional district isn't necessarily saleable on a national level.
That's UMBC political science professor and Baltimore Sun columnist Thomas Schaller here on Maryland Morning, WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress But Surrendered the White House. You mentioned Newt Gingrich of Georgia. He was chosen speaker in 1994 when the Republicans took the House for the first time in 40 years. You assert repeatedly that, quote, Gingrich, not Ronald Reagan, should be remembered as the most significant Republican politician of the past half century, close quote. Why?
Well, first of all, as I pointed out previously, it's been a more Congress-dominant party than a presidential-dominant. If the Reagan legacy was lasting, they would have continued to dominate presidential politics on the Reagan formula, and they haven't been able to do that. And yet they've dominated in the congressional model. And what does that mean? Well, one of the fascinating things about the governing philosophy of conservatives, whatever one thinks, however liberal one might be, the conservatives have, and Republican conservatives specifically, have a different governing philosophy. And it's not necessarily to come in and make major policy leaps to expand the role of government. In fact, it's just the reverse, to contract the role of government, to roll things back. Whereas recent and current Republican Speaker John Boehner said, we should be judged by the laws we repeal, not by the laws that we pass. Think about that for a second, right? That's a fundamentally different governing approach about the proper role and function and size and scope of the government. So when Gingrich runs on the contract with America, which I talk about at some length in the book, if you go back and read the provisions of the contract, it wasn't a series of policies like, here's what we're going to do with Medicare, here's what we're going to do with transportation spending. It's a series of procedural proposals. We're going to ban proxy voting in Congress. We're going to make all members sign a pledge that they'll live to the same rules that average Americans are going to do. We're going to restructure the committee system. We're going to have zero-based budgeting. So they said, we're going to reform the processes of Congress. It wasn't really a bill of policy particulars, whereas Democrats tend to run like Nancy Pelosi and say, hey, if we win the Congress in 2006, we're going to raise the minimum wage, which is a policy outcome in itself. Well, Gingrich realized that you could use procedural politics to capture the Congress. And so when people are surprised that, you know, they're the party of no, to liberal voices, they're like, that's all they do. They stand in opposition to things. But to conservative ears, that is an accomplishment in itself. Not doing something, repealing laws, standing in opposition to what Democrats want to affirmatively do, that's an agenda in and of itself, and an agenda that sells well to conservative ears.
I appreciate your walking us through it. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thomas Schaller. He's a professor of political science at UMBC and author of The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress but Surrendered the White House. We spoke in January. Got more information about the book at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland Morning is an original production of
Your Public Radio,
WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1797, the original USS Constellation, one of six frigates Congress commissioned to confront the Barbary pirates, was launched at Colonel David Stoddard's shipyard on Harris Creek in Fells Point. She saw service in many battles, including the War of 1812, before she was struck for scrap in 1853. At the same time, the keel was laid for the second USS Constellation, the sloop of war we see in Baltimore Harbor today. We'll sail back here Wednesday. Come along with us.